ABC News. I'm John Grimes. Four American servicemen have been killed in an ambush by Somali gunmen near Mogadishu. U.S. military officials say it is the worst casualty toll among American forces since their arrival in Somalia last December. The Americans were escorting a convoy near Mogadishu when one vehicle hit a landmine. The BBC's Roger Hearing tells us,
according to journalists at the scene, it left an 8-foot-wide crater in the road. Gunmen then opened fire with bullets and grenades, and the 6-vehicle convoy was reinforced by Egyptian and Pakistani soldiers and American helicopters. 3 American soldiers died on the spot, according to a UN military spokesman, and a 4th died later in hospital.
The BBC's Roger Hearing in Nairobi, Kenya. So far, the Pentagon has not identified the 4 Americans killed. Richters at the National Earthquake Information Center in Golden, Colorado, jerked twice early this morning. The first time, the needle registered a great earthquake, 8.1 on the Richter, centered just off the coast of Guam. First reports from Agana say there has been some heavy damage and about 40 injuries. And Frank Baldwin at the National Earthquake Information Center says a tsunami warning is posted.
Our information here is that there's been a tidal wave warning, so they're evacuating the low-lying areas of Guam.
A quake in excess of 8 on the Richter scale usually causes widespread devastation. At least 2 major hotels in Agana have been evacuated after floors in each began to crumble. There are reports of cars being flipped from bridges, other bridges have cracked, and there have been landslides. At Anderson Air Force Base on Guam, Major Susan Hankey says there was some damage there.
The only damage that we have on the base so far, of course it's nighttime right now, is that our tower had a fire on the 15th floor. It was an electrical fire, but it was put out almost immediately. We've only had 2 injuries.
Neither was serious. Also early this morning, the Richter registered a minor quake of 3.2 that was felt around Aiken and Eureka, South Carolina. No damage or injuries reported there. You're listening to ABC News.
Hi, David Garner again, president of Connect Long Distance, with a promise and a challenge. If you're like me, you probably get bombarded by all those big boys ads on TV every night. You know, all those high-paid actors touting all those fancy long-distance calling programs. Well, at Connect, we don't have any high-paid actors, just me, with a simple promise. Savings of up to 20% off the big boys' rates, every minute of every hour of every day. Well, that's the promise. Now the challenge. If you run a small business that spends anywhere from $100 to $1,000 a month on long distance, go and grab your last phone bill and call us at 1-800-LONG-DISTANCE. Right over the phone, we'll analyze your actual bill to show you your exact savings with Connect. We'll compare some of your calls or all of your calls if you like. Put us to the test. At Connect Long Distance, we'll show you how we can save you up to 20%. So call us at 1-800-LONG-DISTANCE. That's 1-800-LONG-DISTANCE.
A Swedish pilot bailed out of a new Swedish military jet during an air show over Stockholm, and the empty plane later crashed in the center of Stockholm. There is no immediate report on damage or casualties. First aid helicopters and police have rushed to the scene. Mother Nature continues doling out flood and drought in parts of the U.S. Along the Mississippi below St. Louis, soggy levees are being closely watched. As emergency manager Brian Miller tells us from Cape Girardeau, Missouri,
they're still forecasting at the Cape Girardeau gauge a level of 48.5 to 49 feet.
Miller says the levees could hold back a crest of 50 feet. Agriculture Secretary Mike Espy heads for southeastern states where farmers have been battling drought. There's been some relief lately with rain falling, but for many farmers, it's already too late. South Carolina's Assistant Agriculture Commissioner David Tompkins says for some of the state's chickens farmers, it's too late.
So we saw somewhere around 1.8 million birds in the state that died. I was listening to a story yesterday about one farmer who had a curtain drop in one of his houses and cut off the airflow, and he lost something in the neighborhood of 20,000 birds in about an hour and a half.
And this is ABC News.
Disaster strikes somewhere every single day.
There's people trapped up here. We need food.
Which means every single night, someone needs food, shelter, and a place to rest. Please support the American Red Cross. Call 1-800-842-2200. Because every night is another night. Someone needs your help. This message is brought to you by the American Red Cross and the Ad Council.
For the ABC Information Network, I'm Sean Grimes.
From ABC News, World News This Week. I'm Dorothy McIntyre, ABC News. Listen.
This is just a first step to putting our financial house and our economic house in order.
I could not and should not cast a vote that brings down your presidency.
We'll be back another day to remind you of your folly.
The number of levees that's been torn up, the number of people that's greatly affected. No, I've never seen anything like this.
She just kept saying, "It will be okay, Mommy. It will be okay, Daddy."
In a moment, the people and stories that made this week's world news.
Imagine if drug abusers said exactly what was on their minds.
Hi, Jim. You got a minute?
Only if it's a quick minute, Steve.
Well, it's the Anderson file. We should talk about it.
No, listen, I'd love to, but I was just about to snort some coke.
What'd you say? Snort coke?
That's right. Cocaine. You know, blow, nose candy. I do it all day.
Not your typical office conversation, but consider this. 1 in 7 working Americans uses illegal drugs.
But what about the Anderson file?
Tell you what, let me duck into the men's room, do a couple of lines, and I'll be right with you.
Of course, drug abusers aren't this candid about their problem, but sooner or later, their problem speaks for itself.
Okay, got my head cleared. Now, about that Peterson file.
Anderson file, Jim.
What can you do for someone who needs help? Give them this number, 1-800-662-HELP. That's 1-800-662-HELP. It's the number of the National Drug Abuse Helpline. It's free, it's confidential, and it just may be the help they need. This message brought to you by the Partnership for a Drug-Free America.
Like a football game, the first epic battle of Bill Clinton's presidency turned out to be a game of inches. And like a football game, the fight over the federal budget was full of rough-and-tumble fighting in the trenches. Hard-hitting, grinded-out warfare that ended with a victory for the young president, but by only the margin of an extra point, 2 votes in the House, even closer in the Senate. The budget that eventually passed will raise taxes and cut government spending. Although the Democrats billed it as a deficit reduction package, it won't reduce the federal deficit. It will merely reduce the rate of increase in the debt. And the Republicans, led by Senate Minority Leader Bob Dole, tried hard to portray it as a huge tax increase.
What really bothers me is that President Clinton and the Democrats in Congress are so anxious to raise your taxes, they've made the income tax increase effective January 1, 1993. That's right. You heard it right. January 1, 1993, 20 days before President Clinton even got to the White House.
President Clinton agreed that he was, in fact, asking Congress to raise taxes.
I'm not asking them to do something easy. I'm asking them to do something hard, and I'm proud of the ones that are doing it, and I think when they vote, there'll be a majority. I feel good about it.
Senator Dole said the GOP should have been included in discussions over the final shape of the package.
The president's economic plan calls for more taxes, more spending, and higher deficits. That is why we oppose the bill and why you should oppose it.
Not really, said the president in a broadcast address to the nation on the eve of the crucial vote.
For working families making less than $180,000 a year, there will be no income tax increase. I repeat, for working families making less than $180,000 a year, there will be no income tax increase.
All week, the president worked the phones trying to get his allies in line behind his budget package. The Congressional Black Caucus was of particular concern. Some members had expressed anger about cuts in social programs, but at midweek, Black Caucus Chairman Representative Kwesi Mfume came on board.
We're supporting the package because we believe we have been able, after a long, hard fight, to keep in place some of the cushion for the working poor and the middle class, who we are asking to assume and absorb major cuts over the next 5 years.
Across the Capitol, Senator Dennis DeConcini of Arizona admitted his arm had been twisted a bit by the White House.
It took a little time to make a tough decision, which I just made today, and that is that I will vote for the conference report on the Reconciliation Act.
And so the battle was joined. The Constitution requires that tax bills start in the House of Representatives. And so the first battlefield was the House chamber. Republican Scott Krug of Wisconsin.
Rolling Stone writer P.J. O'Rourke said it best. Giving money to the government is like giving whiskey and the car keys to teenage boys.
Democrat David Bonnier of Michigan.
Say no to gridlock. Say no to the status quo. Don't pass the buck. Pass the plan.
House Majority Leader Richard Gephardt appealed to patriotism.
Surely tonight we can take the responsibility ourselves to see that the country we hand to the next generation is not as good, but is better than the country that was handed to us.
And House Minority Leader Bob Michael warned of dire consequences.
We'll concede, with all the pressure brought to bear by the president and leadership on the Democratic side, that you'll probably have your way for this day, but we'll be back another day to remind you of your folly.
House Speaker Tom Foley even appealed to a higher authority.
The Bible says there is a time for everything. Tonight is a time to decide. Tonight is a time for courage. Tonight is a time to put away the old easy ways. Tonight is a night for responsibility. Tonight is a night to vote. Let us not break faith with our people. Let us pass this plan. Let us move forward to a better day for our country.
And as members of both parties watched the tote boards in the aisles, Presiding Officer Gary Studs announced the final score.
218, the nays are 216. Conference reporters agreed to.
To get his budget through the House, the president agreed with Democratic leaders that further spending cuts would get prompt consideration in September. And as Mr. Clinton noted, the vote in the House took him only halfway to the goal line.
This is just a first step to putting our financial house and our economic house in order. This program is shared sacrifice for shared benefit. We're all in this together, but we have just begun.
All through the debate, the phones on Capitol Hill were ringing off the hook with the voices of people like these.
I believe it's a step in the right direction.
I think it's only going to be bad for the country, all the taxes involved in it.
Well, I'm sure we'll live with it, but I would hope that they would go the other way.
And as the House Democrats handed the ball to the Senate Democrats, Republicans there opened a new offensive. Senator Slade Gorton of Washington said the Supreme Court ruled against retroactive taxes 55 years ago.
Harsh and oppressive. And I quote from the Supreme Court, retroactive taxation violates the due process clause of the Fifth Amendment. Nothing can be more harsh and oppressive than the retroactive nature of this tax on both the living and on the dead.
Senator James Sasser of Tennessee opened the Senate discussion by invoking Democratic Party loyalty.
After 12 years, 12 long years of neglecting the economy and neglecting the physical health of this country, that at long last there's a plan to do something about it.
Republican Bob Packwood of Oregon begged to disagree.
I cannot emphasize more strongly what is going to happen if this bill passes. Bad for the economy, bad for employment, bad for the deficit. Good for those who like government programs and want to expand.
Going into the vote, virtually all the senators had made their votes known, all but one, Bob Kerry of Nebraska. Kerry's vote became crucial. If he voted yes, Clinton would win. A no vote would send the president down to defeat. It was ironic that Kerry's would be the vote because Kerry was one of those who opposed Bill Clinton in the early 92 primaries. And it was ironic that when Kerry finally announced his vote on the Senate floor, he said he wanted to save the Clinton presidency.
President Clinton, if you're watching now, as I suspect you are, I tell you this. I could not and should not cast a vote that brings down your presidency.
And with that, it was up to Vice President Al Gore.
On this question, the yeas are 50, the nays are 50. The Senate being equally divided, the Vice President votes yes, and the conference report on the President's economic plan is passed.
President.
Speaking to the nation the day after the game was won, Mr. Clinton said he'd sign the budget bill on Tuesday.
I congratulate those lawmakers for the courage they've shown in winning this tough fight in the face of all kinds of charges and misinformation that fill the airways. These people stood firm, they stood together, and they stood for you.
Apart from the budget battle, much of America this week had to battle the elements. Water in the Midwest, lack of water in the Southeast. This man lives in Jefferson City, the capital of Missouri.
Devastation this time has surpassed anything that I've seen, especially the amount of homes that it's torn up, the number of levees that's been torn up, the number of people that's greatly affected. No, I've never seen anything like this.
ABC's Bob Schmidt stood under the Gateway Arch in St. Louis and like everyone else, marveled at the power of the Father of Waters.
The Mississippi is coursing past this spot. We're told at the rate of about 8 million gallons per second. People have come here from all over the area and from out of town, too, to just stand on these steps, look at the river, and look in amazement.
A lot of attention was focused on two French colonial towns on the Mississippi. After days of frantic sandbagging, residents of Prairie du Rocher, Illinois, like Larry Valeroy, were almost ready to give it up.
It's just a few inches from the top of the wall, and we got more water coming. It's supposed to be 2 foot of water headed this way.
But the people of Prairie du Rocher dug in and fought harder.
I think the people who were born raised around here maybe knew something. They didn't know. But boy, we got our fingers crossed. This is the last town down this river, and we can't lose it now.
In a desperate move to save their town, residents actually dynamited levees upstream on the Mississippi, diverting the raging floodwaters onto farm fields in the hope of lowering the water level a bit. And in the end, it worked. The flood crest passed, and as reporter Rochelle Rowe told us, the levees held.
There weren't any screams or yells or anything like that when they found out that they had saved the town, because there's still a lot of skepticism that the water will come back up. But they're awfully tired and happy to see it end. And one man told me he was ready for a home-cooked meal. He's tired of eating ham sandwiches on top of the levee.
Across the river, there was some damage to historic buildings in St. Genevieve, Missouri. But the crest passed only 6 inches below the top of the levees, and the town was saved. National Guard Sergeant Russ Martin marveled at the town's unity in the face of disaster.
You'd think with the pressures that are on everybody that, you know, tempers be wearing thin and people getting on each other's nerves, but you see very little of that. You see a lot of people working together, and you see a lot of people who normally don't associate together, just, you know, side by side. So it's just pretty neat.
And that's what cows sound like when the temperature in their barns reaches 114 degrees, as it did in drought-stricken Saluda, South Carolina this week. And as bad as it was for the livestock, said farmer Harry Ott Jr., it was even worse for the crops.
Right now, the corn, it doesn't matter how much rain we get, it's over. It's gone. And if we miss a cotton is a high-money crop for me and most farmers in Calhoun County. And if we miss a cotton crop, it'll put a lot of people out of business.
And as far as soybeans, said Bradley O'Neill, you might as well have planted baked beans last spring.
Soybeans are almost a complete disaster where we are. What few did come up, the extreme heat has just about baked them back down in the ground.
The sound of a minivan pulling out of a driveway, ordinary enough, but in Ann Arbor, Michigan this week, the minivan was driving away with a dream. 2.5-year-old Jessica DeBoer was riding away with her new parents, her birth parents, who won the right to keep her after a battle with the couple who had taken her home at birth. The adoptive father, Jan DeBoer, said in the end, when the last appeal had been denied in court, the DeBoers tried to make it easier for Jessica.
We did the best we could to tell Jessie that she was going away. And by the time that she had left, she knew exactly what was going on. And she knew that our hearts were broken. And she just kept saying, "It will be okay, Mommy. It will be okay, Daddy."
In Iowa, Roberta Schmidt, sister of the little girl's natural father, Dan Schmidt, asked the public to leave her alone.
"We have people saying justice for Jessica. Jessica is home. She is with her mother and father. All I would ask for the public is to please let them get on with their lives and let them get on with this adjustment. To continue battering and tearing this apart does not help anyone."
In Sarasota, Florida, two other families were fighting for a daughter. Kimberly Mays, who was inadvertently switched at birth with another baby, was in court trying to keep her birth parents out of her life permanently. In the trial, nationally broadcast on Court TV, the 14-year-old Kimberly told how the man who had raised her, Robert Mays, had told her what had happened.
"He said that these people were saying that I was their biological daughter, and I started crying, and I said, 'Daddy, don't let them take me away.' And still brings tears to my eyes."
A long-running courtroom drama came to an end this week when federal judge John Davies sentenced two Los Angeles policemen, Stacy Kuhn and Lawrence Powell, to 2.5 years in jail each. The two officers had been convicted of violating the civil rights of motorist Rodney King by beating him in an incident that was videotaped by a bystander. Judge Davies' sentence was much less than federal guidelines might have indicated. The judge said that King had in fact partially provoked the beating by leading the police on a wild chase down the freeways. Congresswoman Maxine Waters said the judge was too lenient.
The sentence of 30 months each with no fines amounted to a kiss on the wrist. The judge was rather lenient, that these officers got off rather easy in this case.
New Los Angeles Mayor Richard Reardon appealed successfully for calm.
Curing L.A. is in your hands. So let us all care. Let us all become neighbors. Let us all work together to be proud to be Angelenos.
In Indiana, the state's highest court threw out boxer Mike Tyson's appeal of his rape conviction. That means Tyson will have to serve his 6-year term in prison. And in Israel, the case of retired Cleveland auto worker John Demjanjuk took an unexpected turn. Israel's Supreme Court, which had acquitted Demjanjuk on charges he was the notorious Nazi death camp guard Ivan the Terrible during World War II, delayed deporting him while prosecutors decided whether or not to charge him with other war crimes. In Jerusalem, Demjanjuk's son-in-law, Ed Nishnik, denounced those delays.
Total disbelief. This is torture. It's absolute torture. What began as a quest for justice here in Israel is quickly turning into an act of revenge, and it is just absolutely unbelievable. It's madness. And it has to be stopped.
For a while, it looked like there could be a lasting ceasefire in embattled Sarajevo, as the U.S. seemed to indicate it would start airstrikes against the Serbs who have besieged the city. The first indication was that President Clinton had decided to go with the airstrikes with or without the support of the European allies. But Mr. Clinton said that would not be the case.
I think the stories this morning perhaps exaggerate our position a bit. Our position is we're working with the allies. We're going to try to work through to a common position.
As the shells continued to echo in the streets of Sarajevo, there were repercussions from another explosion in Los Angeles. It all started when New York Mets outfielder Vince Coleman tossed an explosive out a car window near Dodger Stadium, injuring 3 people. And it'll end in court, according to L.A. District Attorney's Office spokeswoman Suzanne Childs.
The Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office is filing 1 felony count charging Vince Coleman with unlawful possession of an explosive. This is a violation of the Health and Safety Code. It can be charged as either a misdemeanor or a felony and is being filed as a felony.
Near Detroit, a van drove to a park on an island in the middle of the river. And inside, Dr. Jack Kevorkian watched as a 30-year-old man named Thomas Hyde, suffering from Lou Gehrig's disease, committed suicide. Kevorkian was there in spite of a Michigan law against assisting in the suicide, and he said he'll be there again in similar circumstances.
I assisted Thomas Hyde in a merciful suicide. There's no doubt about that. I stated emphatically. I will always do so when a patient needs it because I'm a physician.
In Topeka late this week, a man scheduled to be sentenced on drug charges stormed into the federal courthouse, setting off a car bomb, lobbing explosive devices into a crowd, and locking himself into an office for an all-day siege. Authorities say 37-year-old Jack McKnight died when one of the explosive devices he had attached to his body went off. Violence in the workplace has seemingly become commonplace in these stress-filled times, and no institution seems to typify such violence than the nation's post offices. Indeed, the phrase disgruntled postal worker has become almost a cliche after a series of incidents in which armed postal workers have attacked others in their place of employment. This week, Postmaster General Marvin Runyon said the agency is trying to improve conditions.
We're taking action to assure that our security, treatment of individuals, and management climate are conducive to deterring violence. Much work is still ahead of us.
As the government moved to escape the nation's capital city this week, a lot of things started happening. Laws were passed, nominations were confirmed, and President Clinton said he heard the sound of gridlock being broken in the Senate.
The vote is 96 yeas, 3 nays, and the nomination is confirmed.
Senator Byron Dorgan of North Dakota announced that Ruth Bader Ginsburg would take a seat on the Supreme Court, the second woman to do that. Also in the Senate, Judge Louis Free was confirmed as director of the FBI. A key Clinton campaign promise, establishment of a national service corps that would allow young people to repay some college loans by donating some form of national service, moved through the Congress toward final passage, drawing praise from Senator Edward Kennedy.
As we move away from the me generation to the service generation, this, I think, in many respects, will be a defining issue for this administration, the Clinton administration.
And a new generation moved into power in Japan this week. Morihiro Hasekawa was elected prime minister, the first time since World War II that the once all-powerful liberal Democrats had been out of office. What's better than admiring someone else's riches? Having some riches of your own. Some ordinary people move into much higher tax brackets. As World News This Week continues in a moment.
Are you off the phone yet?
Yeah, Mom, I'm off the phone.
The greatest lesson you can learn about education is that it shouldn't stop after school.
I don't believe this.
What?
Mom, it's 9 o'clock. Don't you ever get your head out of those books?
Look, I'm doing homework like you should be.
I already did it. Listen, I thought the whole reason to get out of school is so you'll never have to do homework again.
I could look at it that way. But then I'd be stuck in the same job all my life, doing the same thing. That's not what I want.
And what do you want?
Something better.
If you think homework is just for kids, you should see what it can do for your career. So keep learning, go back to school, get training, improve your job skills, and you'll find a whole new future waiting for you. It's as simple as ABC. Never stop learning. A message from Project Learning US, the ABC Radio Networks, and this station.
Britain's Queen Elizabeth is reputedly among the richest women in the world. But Her Majesty has recently been a little strapped for liquid assets after a fire at one of her favorite castles and after she agreed to join her subjects in paying income tax. So no sooner did the Queen and her court move out of Buckingham Palace for the cooler highlands of Scotland, and the tourists moved in, thousands of them, paying $12 each for a look inside the enormous royal home. Among those waiting in line, Carol Johnson of New York.
I'm very interested to see what the inside of the palace is like. I know that there's going to be a very long line because the English people will probably beat me there, so I'll have to rush.
And in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, Leslie Robbins stopped off at his favorite grocery store this week to pick up a check, a big one, for more than $55 million. Robbins came with his fiancée, Colleen DeVries, because there was an identical check waiting for her at the local Century supermarket. Robbins was the sole winner of the huge Powerball lottery drawing last month, and he'd made arrangements for his fiancée to split his winnings, 50-50. Robbins and DeVries say being multimillionaires won't change them, although they have done a little splurging.
The only extravagant purchase we've made, we did buy a new condo for our cats because our apartment was... So now they have a bigger apartment than we do, but they're happy. So.
And those are the people and stories that made World News This Week. World News This Week was written and produced by Stu Chamberlain, engineering by Harold Hodge and Sue Klein. I'm Dorothy McIntyre, ABC News, New York.